Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise. I'm your host, David Price. Thank you for joining me today. You will be hearing from Steve and Jerry. They're going to talk about the Guardians of the Galaxy. But first, I will at least let you know that I have read Superior Spider-Man numbers 22 and 23, which are still written by Dan Slott this time. Oh, and Christos Gage, and pencils by Humberto Ramos, and inks by Olazaba. And I, if I said it online this week, if Slott is going where I think he's going, he's one clever dude. Of all the ways that you may think about Peter coming back or fighting to regain his mind or his body, I kind of didn't see this one coming. And if it doesn't happen this way, then, you know, great, cool, you know, super. I'm still keen on it all. But if it does, I'm interested to see how this plays out. Because the last time the symbiote wanted to be one with Peter again, I'll say, I think it was back when Anti-Venom was introduced, and I do remember the Avengers Spider-Man, who was the Dark Avengers Venom, wanted to reattach to Peter, wanting to be with Peter over the Gargan. So I can see the symbiote jogging things or fighting Otto, and it'll just be neat. And I'm not giving anything away, I hope. The covers kind of let you know that Venom is involved in this storyline. But seeing Peter and Cardiac and Flash and Aunt May and Peter's girlfriend and Maria and everybody together in one room, and it's, yeah, even Otto is feeling that old Parker luck. And even though Parker Industries is a dream fulfilled, you can't be too certain that everything is going to work itself out. I have some amazing X-Men to read. I have the second issue of that to read next. And a couple of annuals. I did read Deadpool Annual, which the guys and I were going to... I read it to talk about on 11 o'clock this week, so I'm going to hold off my thoughts on that fun, super fun Deadpool comic. And of course, finished Infinity. Infinity number 6 and the epilogue in New Avengers, I think 14. But I really enjoyed Infinity. Looked gorgeous. I really have no complaints with how it ended, how we got to the conclusion. There are a couple of comics I read where it feels like they're rushed as we get to the end of the issue. This, not so much. I think that Hickman and his artists plan things out pretty well. I really have no complaints with how everything was laid out and played out. And I'm really happy with the conclusion. I'm overall really happy with the event. In general, also read some Savage Wolverine from a couple months ago. It involved Elektra and an appearance by Spider-Man. I believe it's part of the Zeb Wells Joe Mad hardcover Spider-Man Wolverine, because it also includes the three issues of Avenging Spider-Man, and where Spidey took on the Mole Men and this was a the Savage Wolverine story was pretty well, it definitely was savage. There were some things about Wolverine that really didn't ring true. His inner monologue, how he's thinking about things and before he does them, I'm not really feeling Zeb's version of Wolverine, or at least how this Wolverine thinks or feels. But it was awesome to see the brown and tan back. Love that uniform, or costume or outfit, whatever you want to call it. And yeah, and the Kingpin was involved. It's an older story. It doesn't happen in current continuity, which is fine. I have absolutely no problems with telling stories from back in the day. And you can also tell because it was definitely Peter's body and mind, wearing the Spider-Man costume, and there was also the older Spidey costume. It wasn't the current Superior Spider-Man look. And that's pretty much it. So I have some things to read. Once I'm done here, I'm going to let Steve and Jerry tell you all about the first dozen plus issues of Guardians of the Galaxy by Jim Valentino and Montano. And yeah, so you guys are going to listen to that. I'm going to listen to that. I will talk to you all soon. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Hey, future Guardians. Steve Raker and Jerry McDade here from the Comic Book Bunker, where we've got another installment of our sweeping history of the Guardians of the Galaxy. No, not the Guardians of the Galaxy that you know of now. No, not the Guardians of the Galaxy that are going to be in the major motion picture next year. But the old Guardians of the Galaxy, the ones that spanned the previous, 35 years of Marvel's history.
The good stuff.
Yeah, so welcome back, Jerry. Glad you're taking the time to rejoin us here to go over this stuff.
Well, greetings, Herald of Galactus. Greetings from one who knows nothing, nothing at all.
And I particularly appreciate you taking the time because you've been busy yourself over on the Great Expectations podcast. You guys cover Shakespeare in the Park over there or what?
Absolutely. Yes, we are well-read and all-knowing. So, no, we actually discuss the X-Men and a lot of the X-Men. And it's kind of a mad rush to get through 50 years of X-Men history in, well, what do we got now? 8 hours so far. But come check us out.
I suggest that you do so, and now that you're in the podcasting arena yourself, you know what a time drain it can be, as well as fun, so I appreciate you being willing to have some more fun and spend some time again with us over here.
It's all fun and no work for me.
So this time in the Guardians, where we last left off was really their first big chunk of publishing time between 1969 and the early 80s. And then, just like it's been several episodes since, I think it was episode 204 when we covered the early stuff, there was kind of a Dark Guardians period where, no, not dark like the Chris Claremont X-Men dark. Stop thinking X stuff, Jerry.
I can't help it.
But there was sort of a Guardians blackout from like the time just before I got out of comics in the mid-80s, really until the spring of 1990 when Jim Valentino, who would later leave with the Image guys to go start Image, as one of the founders there, Valentino's big contribution to the Marvel Universe, besides doing a lot of writing and art on the second volume of What If, was to revive the Guardians of the Galaxy and give them, for the first time, truly their own title ongoing series.
Well, thank goodness for him that he did it.
And it ran for 60-some-odd issues, and we're going to get into the, well, kind of like Mel Brooks in the History of the World Part 1, where he's Moses and presents the 15. Well, we've got the first 20, 16 issues of the Guardians of the Galaxy run that began in the spring of 1990 when Jim Valentino would bring back these characters and give them the attention that they really deserve. And I really fell in love with these characters again in this run. I thought it was a lot of fun stuff.
Well, it's time to be honest with your fans, Steve. This is the first time I've read these, and I wasn't expecting much. I left comics around late 88, early 89, and I knew these came out right at the start of the 90s, and nothing I'd ever touched from the 90s was very good. So going into this, I wasn't really expecting much, especially when greeted with knowing nothing going into this. I see, are they ready for Taserface? on the opening page and in the credits, Taserface created by Aaron Valentino.
Which I'm guessing is Jim's son, perhaps?
It was his 5-year-old son.
All right.
The youngest creator ever at Marvel.
And what was cool about this, it had... And I think the cosmic titles of the 90s, which is where I think Marvel shined at that time, had this family feeling because of the group editor of the Marvel Cosmic at the time, who was editor Craig Anderson, who I think is a sort of forgotten, benevolent contributor and caretaker of the Marvel Cosmic and in Marvel Comics history. Surprisingly, I just found out recently from talking to Ron Mars that he is Bill Anderson of Marmaduke's son.
Oh, no way.
So he's often, he's Marmaduke money. So that's whatever happened to Craig Anderson, cosmic editor of the 90s, who brought Jim Starlin back in and the Thanos stuff and the Infinity stuff and all that business, and this Guardians of the Galaxy title was under Craig Anderson, and I think he even writes the Sunday strips of Marmaduke wherever they still exist. And Tom DeFalco was the editor-in-chief, so that's kind of the editorial creative landscape. But this was a stable book. You had Jim writing and drawing, Valentino that is, and Steve Montano on the inks. And right through these first 16 issues, at least, the creative team doesn't change at all, which is really nice.
Now, this was a monthly book, is that right?
Yep. I mean, they get better as they go on. Obviously, Valentino's young here.
Right.
And he's still learning his chops, and he gets better throughout the series. One of the nice gags of the series was that every cover, although penciled by Valentino, would have a guest inker.
Yeah, I noticed that. And not just chumps, either.
No, we've Mike Zeck, Scott Williams, Todd McFarlane, Joe Rubenstein, Perez, Steve Lytle, Rob Liefeld, Jim Lee, Art Tiebert, Jim Starlin even.
And a Simonson cover, right?
Yeah, really neat. And fun at the times when we were picking it up to see who the next cover inker would be and how it would affect Valentino's art.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing back when I was getting it. Never mind.
Well, I think that's cool that you were willing to take this trip, and I think I'm so glad that you're the person that I'm taking this ride with, since you're reading this stuff for the first time, but had a fondness for the Guardians, while at the same time having a lack of fondness for this time period in Marvel Comics.
Well, you rewarded me with a great story, so thank you.
The first 6 issues is kind of a grand sweeping story arc that's broken up into the first kind of 4 issues, and then issues 5 and 6. And I should also mention that this material is being reprinted in a trade paperback right now that was solicited maybe last month or the month before, and should be on the shelves later this month or next month into the beginning of 2014.
Well, all right.
Yeah. The beginning of these Guardians tales starts, it's the year 3017. The Guardians are back in the future, as they should be, and the first issue takes the time to introduce the cast, which we should do here. There's Charlie 27 from Jupiter. He's the strong guy, right?
Yes.
But also the pilot and the military strategist.
And the best of the group, in my opinion.
And did you like the improvement in his attire and outfit in this series, as opposed to the old wrestling mask?
It's still pretty S&M to me, but I really dig it. Yeah, it's cool. And Valentino nails his face, too. The squinty eyes and big eyebrows, it feels straight from that late 60s appearance to me. I love it.
A lot of things vibes from that Arnold Drake and Colin material, I think. And we'll actually get to that as some stuff comes full circle from that time period.
Oh, yeah.
There's Starhawk, who is an Arcturian, and he wields light powers, and he shares his physical form with a female, Alita. And he's one who knows, as we're often reminded.
Well, we know that now, too.
There's also Martin X, and he's from Pluto. Each of the Guardians are kind of the last of their race, for the most part, in one of Earth's colonies on one of the other planets in our solar system. And they were genetically modified to be able to tolerate the environment on each of the planets. So Martin X being from Pluto, way out there in the ice, he's silicone-based. He's got a crystalline shell, and he's the master of thermal energy, but he's also the scientist of the group.
I love this guy. He's got the best look as far as the character appearance to me. I always thought he was the coolest looking guy.
I wonder if you'll continue to think that as we get through these issues.
I don't want to spoil it.
There's also Yondu. He's the last from Alpha Centauri, and he is basically an analog of an American Indian. He's an archer, he's a weapons master, he has a certain spirituality, he's a little bit mystic and kind of one with his planet and his people. The tradition is very important to him, etc.
And he has a giant fin on his head, which has gotten about 570% bigger now that Valentino is drawing it.
There's also Nikki. She's the last flame-tressed Mercurian, and she's just an agile fighter and an all-around firecracker.
She's great. And Valentino really focuses on her best assets while he draws her.
Yeah, I'm a leg man. There's also Major Buck Rogers, Vance Astro. And he's from Earth. He's the last survivor of the 20th century. He's got the Buck Rogers origin, people. But he's got the powers of psychokinesis.
You don't mess with psychokinesis.
And unfortunately, because he's the 1,000-year-old man, his body is sealed in a containment suit that must never be ruptured lest he start turning to dust.
Yes, that absolutely 100% will happen if he even gets a scratch in the suit. Or it doesn't every time he gets a scratch in his suit. More on that later.
The issue opens with the team in battle, and it's funny, their cry is, it's clobbering time, because they've met the thing before. Star-Lord becomes Alita, and she's got this shiny golden armor over a black bodysuit thing going on, and is very and I said Star-Lord, didn't I? I meant Starhawk. And she's very un-Starhawk-like in her attire here. We've never seen her like this before.
No, and you really get to see her in this costume. There's a very deep V in the front of it, folks. This is barely PG-13.
I like that she's got this old Supergirl choker, though. I used to like when Supergirl had the choker.
Yeah, you did.
We get a pretty comprehensive 4-page history of the Guardians of the Galaxy's adventures in the 70s and the 80s. It's all the stuff we talked about on episode 204. I thought it was great. They really did a nice job nailing it down there.
Yeah, it's amazing that they were able to fit that much. It took us 3 hours to fit this much information in.
And all the research I did to even find those appearances, had I just gone to this, if I had only remembered that they had done this great recap, it's really quite comprehensive, from the Thor issues to the Marvel team-up, etc.
Well, I hope you learned your lesson, Steve.
They also set up the entire flavor of this series kind of with a meta comment when they point out that they're really seem, as they look back on their adventures, that they're kind of inexorably tied to the events of the 20th century. And that's a theme we'll continue to see throughout the series. The goal of the first 6-issue arc, in fact, is a quest for an ancient artifact.
So cool. You know, I remember seeing this artifact with a certain member of this team somewhere in print, and I always wondered how he ended up with that. I could swear it was the Handbook of the Marvel Universe, but I don't know what edition it would have been, so it must have been something else. And it's great to finally find out what the story is.
They know of a legend of what looks like a loosely drawn breakdown drawing. There's only one red and one white stripe on it, but it looks like it's Captain America's shield to one who has seen it before, like Vance.
It seems very obvious.
So that's the quest, to find Captain America's shield.
He gotta have it.
They then battle the armored alien Taser Face. And do you know, just a fun fact, do you know what why the taser is called a taser?
No.
It's not because it's like laser taser. It's the Thomas A. Swift electric rifle. Named after Tom Swift, the old Tom Swift novel series.
Out of here.
He was like a young inventor who went on these adventures and had a series of novels similar to like the Hardy Boy novels and stuff of of our parents, basically, as youths. So it's the Thomas A. Swift electric rifle, T-A-S-E-R. That's the taser. Because he created something similar.
I have to have one now.
Now Taser Face seems cool, right?
Tom Swift book for a birthday when I was like 9 years old. I was like, who is Tom Swift?
My dad had a bunch of them that I like found in my grandmother's basement that were still there, and I read a bunch of them as a kid.
Everyone should know that I am not as old as Steve's dad.
You're not barely not even as old as I am, so.
No, not even close. I'm a baby.
So we get the back and forth between Alita and Starhawk. Alita begrudgingly agrees to become Starhawk again because they feel that Starhawk is more powerful to be able to fend off this Taserface dude.
Of course he is.
And at the end of the first issue, we meet Taserface's brethren, the alien race who introduce themselves as...
The Stark.
The Stark? That's where the armor comes from.
That's right.
In the second issue, we've got a big battle with the Stark, and Vance's suit becomes breached, a big, like, cut across his chest. His skin starts to oxidize and bubble up and everything. It doesn't look good.
No, it's a bad look, and he's not handling it well.
It's even smoking a little. It probably smells bad, like hair burning. Ugh.
It's probably because he hasn't had that suit off in 1,000 years. I'm just guessing.
My python boot is too tight. A week went by, now it's July. I finally got it off, and my girlfriend cried. You got skin foot. There's a 5-page interlude with the Watcher, where he gives us the Stark's history, and introduces a more experienced, more responsible Fire Lord, who is that time era's protector of the universe, much as Mark Gruenwald's Quasar was the protector of the universe at this time in Marvel's history. So that protector of the universe variable was really well established at that time, so it really made sense for them to reference it and have an equivalent.
It's interesting, too, that you mentioned Quasar. In a discussion about the Guardians of the Galaxy, did you pick up on a reference to him later on?
When they have Ego or that kind of thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you guys know Fire Lord, right, is Galactus's former hot-headed herald who burns bright and often is at odds with anyone he encounters before.
Anyone, right?
It's true. In the history, we learn that during the Martian invasion, the Killraven time, which is part of the Guardians timeline, as we learned in our episode 204 there, during the Martian invasion, Iron Man shot all his armors and tech off into deep space, too vain to really destroy it, but at the same time not wanting the Martians to get their hands on it. And ultimately it gets found by a race, and over centuries they learn how to tinker with it and even name themselves after their progenitor, the Stark.
They've got a giant statue dedicated to him. It's awesome. And this is where I started digging the series, because of all the callbacks to stuff that had happened before.
Yes.
And to the timeline, and then the tone. Here they go into all this detail about how the Stark are ruining their environment and stuff. It just kind of recalled the same history that Earth had, and I think the same tone of storytelling that Gerber used. You know, whether someone like Steve's political or environmental beliefs might tie in with with what's going on in this story. I think the tone was similar, and that kind of dragged me in.
Yeah, I mean, where else but in science fiction and in comics can you just explore the extreme outcomes of any particular philosophy or prediction, if you will? I mean, we're talking about the future here, so let's see which predictions came true, right? And if you have the universe to explore, you can have a lot of different planets to make that happen. It's the Star Trek bit. It's what's best about science fiction, really.
Yeah. And for the Stark, it either got really bad or the inker's pen started running out of ink because there's a lot of black smeared all over the page. And I'm just guessing that's bad air.
You know, their planet that stripped of resources because of their over-technological desires being the Stark-based. Everyone needs the latest armor, right? And think about how many times our Iron Man changes armors. These guys must, too. So they're kind of forced to become imperialistic intergalactically, and they're spreading their cancer, if you will, across the universe.
Well, if cell phones ever start getting built into armor, we can expect this to happen to us as well.
And at the end of this issue, the Guardians are kind of beaten to a standstill with the Stark, but Alita is blasted, and she actually splits with Starhawk, and they're kind of both laying there crackling with energy.
That's probably not a good thing, I'm guessing.
No, so the first thing they do in issue 3 is get Alita up to the sick bay. Starhawk is conscious, but he splits on the team, gives him the one who knows all line as he does so, of course.
Yeah, they seem to like it less every time he does it, too.
There's also an interlude where we meet a squad of aliens calling themselves Force, and they reveal that they're after the shield, too.
This is another cutscene that starts getting me excited about this series, because it seems like Valentino's starting to pull a Claremont here. This is where you first start feeling it, where he's starting to lay track for stories down the road.
But what's cool is that in these first 16 issues, no loop isn't closed.
Right.
So you're not waiting too long, which is kind of a neat
thing. Right. Yeah. Are you implying that Claremont waits too long?
Yeah, well, there's only lists on the internet of, like, the plot lines that were never, like, brought up again.
He didn't have enough time, Steve. It's not his fault.
Taserface is beaten again. This guy needs to level up. He's already been shamed and stripped of his name by their matriarch. This is a pretty matriarchal society, the Stark is. And now he's like the no-named warrior, and he's beaten again. So this isn't going to go well for his reputation.
Poor guy. It's because of that name, I'm telling you. The best thing that ever happened to him was getting stripped of that name.
The team regroups on their ship, and Vance gets some adamantium casting over his wounds to close him up.
It's just that easy, folks.
Yeah. Alita awakens, so that's a good sign. But the issue ends with the ship being attacked and blown up by an orbiting Stark vessel just before Starhawk returns.
That's not going to be good for anyone.
And Starhawk knew he wasn't going to make it back in time, but he never does, Jerry.
Well, that's because he's always leaving.
The fourth issue begins showing Starhawk attacking the Stark vessel and holding them off. And Fire Lord arriving, that's what Starhawk had to leave and go do, was shoot a beacon for Fire Lord to see and arrive. Fire Lord's mission is to beat back the Stark some, so their missions are unified here.
And now you really know you're in the 90s, because even Fire Lord has a mullet.
Well, Fire Lord gets directed by the one who knows to the planet. Where the Guardians are alive. They're again battling the Stark. They teleported down there just before the blast, Jerry.
Thank goodness. I was really worried.
Made for a good cliffhanger ending for the third issue, though.
You gotta have one. It's issue 3.
The guy who once was called Taserface makes a final assault and does quite a bit of damage to the team. Martinix is, like, losing shards of crystal from his surface all over the place. But Fire Lord arrives and, like, completely incinerates the guy. But he's still living as they leave. He's still moving around.
Yeah, I guess I didn't catch that when I read it because, well, I won't say why, but it was surprising later on that he survived.
We get another...
I didn't say that.
We get another interlude with Force, and we get to see who their roster is, and that one of them is a female Alpha Centaurian. And that's important for Yondu, because he's all about the fact that he is the last of his race.
Well, they all are, but it turns out he isn't.
But
yay!
He wears the earrings, though. Nobody else wears the earrings to say that they're the last of their race.
That's right.
It's like their mating call earrings.
They are pretty hot.
The Guardians of the Galaxy assimilate the Stark's much larger ship and name it the Captain America 2.
Woo! And they even use the Captain America font from that time. It's awesome!
And they make Fire Lord an honorary Guardians of the Galaxy and give him a little star that he can use to communicate and teleport back to their ship whenever needed, which is a handy little tool.
And guys, he's so happy wearing it. You should see. Buy it just to see how happy Fire Lord is.
He's so happy that he gives them a lead on where the shield is, too.
What a guy.
So that's kind of the first four-issue arc with the Stark, and issues 5 and 6 get us back to chasing down the shield.
Ooh, should we mention that Nikki has really fallen for this Fire Lord dude?
They have the same hairdo.
They do. I mean, they're a match made in heaven, right?
The Guardians here split up to face off against Force when they arrive at the planet where the shield is being kept. And it's great. They do little chapters with, you know, their own little logos of each of the characters. And it's so like the old JLA, JSA type, you know, crossover chapters where that was, as we've learned throughout comics history, that was the way that they didn't have to draw so many characters all together on the page, was they would split them off into sub-chapters. So that's where that came from. But so it's really fun here that they go with that.
That's a cool story. This is the first issue that I really started really enjoying.
Part one is Charlie and Martinex versus Broadside, who's this big chick, and Brawl, who was one of the minions of Korvac way back in Thor Annual 5, Jerry.
Yes, keep bringing it back. Bring back the old days. I love it.
The Guardian characters here, Charlie and Martinex, they're beaten pretty handily, and Marty loses a ton more shards of his skin casing.
I'm not real happy about that, Steve. These are my two favorite guys, and they just get manhandled. But let's just say it's Chuck's fault. The Broadside lady, who's large, we'll say, and very well built, comes on to him, and he decides he's not having any of it.
She's large.
She's large.
Right. Part two is Yondu and Nikki versus Photon, who is like Miss Yondu, and Scanner, who is a snark, one of those reptilian aliens that were introduced back in the old
Power
Lee Simonson, June Brigman Power Pack.
That book was my jam.
It even looks like June Brigman drawing it when you look at it here.
Yeah, early on it does. He gets a little crazy later, but definitely June Brigman here.
I got to meet her, actually, when I was 13 or 14. Whenever Power Pack first started, I had her sign the first couple of issues for me.
Oh, if anybody ever hears of her being at a show, a convention, let me know. I would love to get a sketch from her.
She was very nice to me as a 13-year-old or 14-year-old, whatever it was.
Did she pat your head?
Yondu, he's not going to fight Photon. So he is pretty much beaten. And very much like Contest of Champions, as soon as they're beaten, like they dematerialize. Or as soon as they win, they dematerialize and are teleported to another spot together. Nikki, she hates lizard men, right? Reminds her of the Badoon. So she totally mops the floor with Scanner.
Well, that it's partially because he's terrible, I guess. And partially because she hates him.
When the four Guardians are reunited together, Charlie is holding Marty, who is all shattered, and they fear that he's dead.
Fear nothing, they say it.
Issue 6 is the conclusion of this story arc, and we get Starhawk and Alita in part 3 of these separated battles here, versus 85, who is a Magneto type, who beats Alita by just encasing her in a metal tomb. And Tachyon, who is just that. He's just this little quiet energy being who kind of repels any energy that you shoot at him stronger. So it ends up being kind of a draw between him and Starhawk.
Yeah, and what's his name? 86?
85.
85? Freddie Mercury, right?
Yeah. I was thinking Corsair with the color scheme, too.
That was the first thing I thought, yeah. But yeah,
he's with a big lizard.
Yeah, why not?
Starhawk and Alita are teleported to the others, and Starhawk tries to heal Martinex with his light and manages to keep him sustained. Whew. Part 4 is Vance Astro versus Interface, who is the leader of Force, and he is like an alchemist. And the shield that they're looking for, Captain America's freaking shield, is right between them.
It's so close.
Interface immediately just reopens Vance's chest wound and grabs the shield. Battle over.
Wow, that was pretty anticlimactic.
It's just that simple, folks.
And in not a new spot either, just the same spot that got ripped before.
But it's a great setup for the punchline, which this guy Interface, he's shocked to learn that as he holds up the shield and starts barking orders at people, he can't bend people's will to his. With the shield's magical properties don't seem to be working.
He must not be using it correctly.
Could the legends be wrong? Bah. And he just chucks it. You want it, Vance? Here you go. But he doesn't toss it right to him. He makes Vance crawl to it.
Fortunately, Vance is worthy, so he has the ability to crawl across the floor like Captain America would.
And once he grabs the shield and stands with it, he gives a Cap soliloquy that would knock your socks off.
My socks literally flew off. How did you know that?
Force is teleported away by the sentient mainframe computer intelligence that is controlling the planet and set up the challenges and stuff. And the mainframe is revealed to be
the Vision.
Another callback. So we're getting, this is littered throughout the 60 plus issues of this series, guys, and it might really turn you off to it. But if you are familiar with Marvel's history, or at least have a pretty good working knowledge of it, you're pretty much going to get all the callbacks and really enjoy it. And I thought it was a really fun part of this whole series. It was like an archaeology aspect of, you know, the whole series to see what happened and what things formed into what.
Yeah, for me, I think that and the melodrama that starts going on from here forward between the characters are the two strengths of the series.
Well, the Vision mainframe, he explains what the tests and the trials of each of them were. It wasn't necessarily what they thought. And he also clues them in on the fate of the mutants. If you remember, the last living colony of free humans wasn't humans at all, but they were mutants who Magneto took on a pilgrimage away from Earth during the Martian invasion, and we don't know whatever happened to them. And that was the whole point of the old 1969 Arnold Drake, Gene Colan issue when the Guardians first got together. They had to find the lost colony of Earthmen, who later they learned were mutants.
And if you didn't know that going into this and you read it, don't worry about it, because I did read those issues. We talked about them on this show, and I had forgotten all about it.
What's cool is Galactus and the Keeper are also mentioned in passing, too. We won't get back to them on this episode, but in a future installment, that is going to play into things. The identity of the Keeper is pretty cool. So, they're off to find the lost colony of the Free Earthmen. Dun-dun-dun!
Yay.
Issue 7 is a standalone split book. Issue 7 and 8 actually are both standalone stories that are really heavy on character development, which is great. And how it's a split book is vertically. There's like one story going across the top and the other on the bottom, which makes me think of that old John Byrne FF issue where the Thing found out that Johnny was marrying Alicia or whatever, right?
Right. Yeah, this was tough for me to read. I can see why they don't do more of these.
In the top story, the Guardians of the Galaxy encounter this pink demon named Malvolence, and she's looking for some child. And in the bottom story, Starhawk helps heal Martinex's shattered exterior, and he also shares his and Alita's origin story, as we shared with you back on episode 204, and adding in how he is one who knows. He has lived his life before, and we haven't gotten to the point where he starts to loop over again, but he cryptically alludes to it.
That was a really neat revelation. I was surprised by that.
In the last 5 pages, the stories combine, and to really demonstrate that. They're all large full-page panels or splash-page panels for those last five pages. So you go from reading these little horizontal half-page sequences to these big splash-page pages, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Starhawk confronts Malvolence. He says she's early and that kid's not here yet. And Malvolence is, like, cursing the heavens, cursing her father. Hint, hint. Pink demon.
Yeah, big surprise who this is. Yeah, if you see her, it won't be a surprise.
Yeah, and she splits. She's like, I'm out of here. So the Guardians are looking for an explanation from Starhawk, but he continues to just be cryptic like he is. And the team, Jerry, they're not having any of that.
No, they want answers and they want them now.
But Marty shows up. He's walking. His exterior is now metamorphosized. It's all like a flat carbon crystal. It's still sort of crystalline, but it doesn't seem so shiny and seems more flat and carbony to me. It's not prismy.
Yeah, much less angular.
Yeah, and it's opaque. But he backs Starhawk up. He says, I've heard his story, and, you know, trust him. He's one who knows. Dope.
For now.
Issue 8 is also a character issue, and we start with the Guardians of the Galaxy training Danger Room style. And I like how Nikki is growing her flaming hair long.
Yeah.
She's getting a good look.
That's a really cool little bit of, I guess, physical character development.
And it's cool how when she explains, who mentions it to her, maybe Charlie says something to her about her, you know, I like how you're growing your hair long or whatever. And she's like, oh, silly, I just have to release more heat, that Mercurians release their high body heat through their head.
Through the pores in their head, yeah.
And that's why she's got the flaming head, so she just lets a little more out. Hilarious. Yondu, during this training session, this Danger Room session, he is so withdrawn and distracted because he's met a female of his race, and she wanted nothing to do with him or any tradition or felt any responsibility to their people or anything, that he ends up being distracted, and he's like a danger to himself and the team.
I'll say.
We get another one of Valentino's interludes. Here we get the Starks' home planet, where the High Priestess is having the nameless shamed one horribly tortured, Jerry.
Yeah, he's not in good shape, guys. I'm worried about him.
But then we get Nikki in the bath.
Oh, see, it's all better.
And her hair goes out in the tub, so you see that she's bald and has, like, pointy elf ears? Hilarious.
Yeah, and unfortunately, all that heat coming out of her creates a lot of steam in the room, so you can't see as much as you would think.
Nikki rebukes her former love interest, Charlie's kind of advancements, and gives him the old, but we'll always be good friends kind of a thing, much to his chagrin.
Oh, he's entered the friend zone.
And Martin X, meanwhile, is considering, he's the leader of the Guardians. Somewhat begrudgingly, he thinks Vance would do a better job. But he considers, like, an Avengers-like expansion and is thinking of a group of kind of galactic Guardians that, again, won't mean anything for these during these first 16 issues, but later on down the line, it's a reality that comes to fruition. And some of the characters that we meet during these first 16 issues become members of that roster.
And art-wise, this is my favorite page out of the 16 issues that we read. They kind of cut from Charlie's room, pan out through his window, out into space, and across the ship, you see all their little bedroom windows lined up, and you see him standing in his window really tiny. And then they kind of zoom back in on Marty's room, just a couple doors down, and it kind of gives you an idea of how their personal spaces arranged in the ship, because you wonder in your head how their personal lives work. Literally a cool window into their lives.
You're waiting for Elliot R. Brown to come up with one little map in the back.
Yeah, where is it?
You know, he wasn't still with Marvel at that time. I think he was gone by then. We get another interlude where Starhawk is noting a mass extermination of what he calls non-productives across the galaxy by the Knights of the Sacred Faith. And that is what will be the final story arc here as issue 16 approaches.
And I'm looking at the page now, and don't they make reference to something about non-humans? Yeah.
Yeah, anyone who isn't humanoid. So anyone who doesn't have two arms, two legs is considered a non-productive and is gotten rid of because they don't share the resemblance to the maker.
Yeah, this page was pretty brutal and it made me frowny. I didn't like it.
Throughout the series, and I think really shown in these two standalone character development type issues of 7 and 8, we really get a great use of thought balloons to develop the characters, I think, and give a lot of insights into the characters. And they're so concerned about each other and what's going on with each other that when the characters' thoughts are revealed, I found it to be two birds with one stone twice revealing, because you're often in the same set of thoughts really learning something about the character who is thinking those thoughts, but also about the character that he's thinking about as he sort of ponders what that character is wrestling with. These guys all really care about each other, and it adds to that soap operatic drama that can only really best be realized when you have a nice tight cast that's consistent like this.
Yeah, well, as is revealed at some point in this series, they've been together now for 10 years out in space with just the seven of them. So they've probably learned everything there is to know about each other at this point. Can't help but be close.
Yondu, though, surprises everyone a little. He hijacks the ship. He's going to look for Photon. He's like in heat. He's got to find this girl. He's on a mission from God, you know?
His fin is engorged. And it is red.
His dewlap.
Yes.
They engage Yondu and wrestle a little bit with him, but Charlie takes him out with one punch.
Maybe a little too hard for some people's liking.
Vance have quarters, we learn, that mimic his suit environmentally. Got kind of a Mr. Freeze going on thing, so he can expose his skin within his quarters and feel sheets against him and feel other things against him, too.
What? Whoa. Hold on.
Knock, knock, knock. Alita shows up, and she's looking to bum Buglies.
Yeah, she doesn't really mince words about it either. And it's really convenient for Vance, because the last thing he says before she walks in is, "No one else can come in. Only me." And then here comes Alita.
She doesn't
carry a being of pure light.
Exactly. She doesn't carry any bacteria with her. And Vance is hesitant, but he pretty much gives in, even though he feels guilty about it.
Well, he lasts as long as he has to before he gets the okay from Not Star-Lord!
It's even worse that Star-Lord is a current Guardian of the Galaxy, right? So it makes the Freudian slip connection even a tighter set of neurons there. So
well, with all this, this time travel, maybe they can just merge them somehow.
The last three pages have our team arriving at Haven, which is considered to be the planet with the lost colony of the mutants that Magneto led from Earth. And they hail the planet, and down at the planet answering is their leader, who is shown to be a female Wolverine type named Rancor. With the same Wolverine font.
The same Wolverine font. I like that touch.
Here we get the 9, 10, and 11th issues being a three-part World of the Mutants, which it's stamped right on the cover. In issue 9, on the ground, Haven is really anything but. It's a planet dying of volcanic activity, Jerry.
And dying to get rid of its mutant overlords.
Yeah. Generations of fewer mutants occurred as the time went on, and it turns out now there's only 9 mutants left, but they rule with an iron fist, and they're keeping the people down in a police state.
Yeah, I was really surprised by this. I was not expecting this to be the case, but I guess where Magneto's involved, I probably should have expected it.
The underground human rebellion leader is named Gerard, or Jerry, if we want to call him that.
Let's call him that.
He's got hope. Old Jerry does, in the form of an old legend of the Overmen arriving to free them from bondage. Just like the song, Jer, the Overmen will come and throw her in a volcano, in a volcano, in a volcano. Sing along if you know the words, everybody.
I don't know the words.
It just sort of repeats a lot about throwing her in a volcano. The Guardians of the Galaxy, they hook up with Gerard here. and hear the history of Haven, founded by Magneto's mutants, ruled by Logan's line. And Rancor is a fifth generation, and she's the one that decided to just enslave the human race and get this thing over with.
Oh, and there's a very, very quick one-panel appearance by Apocalypse.
Yeah, who wiped out the... chased the mutants off of Europa, where they stopped to build their bigger space arc that they didn't have the time to build on Earth because the Martians were attacking. So they just got off planet, went to Europa, because that's the nearest water body, right? Everyone thinks the core of Europa is warm enough because of being Jupiter's gravitational pull, so that there's water and possibly warm enough water to use. They tie it in with Guardians history because the Guardians say, hey, we actually, that's where we found the first Captain America ship, was on this little, was on Europa or whatever, and there was a little base that was kind of abandoned, and that was what was left of their arc-building hangars there.
That's right. They built three ships and conveniently left one behind for the Guardians.
Yeah, the Santa Maria, I'm guessing. The team splits up, and half of them go to negotiate diplomatically with Rancor. We'll see how that goes. And half go to rally the Resistance, who, just before they go to rally the Resistance, they've been utterly crushed. But there is a shape-changing replica-named girl who was there, the Rebellion's ace in the hole, and she witnesses everything but hides and stays out of sight. So she's the only survivor of the Resistance.
This innocent, unassuming little girl, there's no reason to suspect anything is off about her.
Another interlude, back to the Stark world, where the High Priestess is now modifying the old Nameless One into something uniquely powerful. Overkill. Like the old Men at Work song.
Or like this whole comic, Overkill.
At least his aspect of it. He's so over the top, you know? Will he ever win? Starhawk is off meeting with the Phoenix Force. This is the mutants, guys. What, they weren't going to touch upon the Phoenix Force? And it is alive but trapped without a human host inside one of the volcanoes. When the issue ends, half of the gang is captured. Guess which half? The ones who went to diplomatically negotiate with Rancor.
Never diplomatically
negotiate.
And the
other half are on the lam with whatever's left of the Resistance. In issue 10, the Guardians of the Galaxy tell the populace of the people, while Vance is holding up the shield high, that the overmen of their legends have arrived, and it doesn't take long for the square to fill and statues to start coming down.
That's right.
But the mutants, there's only nine of them, but they engage brutally. And Gerard is, he's going to get taken out, but Starhawk swoops in, pulls Gerard from the heat of battle, and... pretty much throws him in a volcano.
See, well, he asks his permission first.
Vance,
sort of.
With his shield, and the crowd are going as far as now breaching the castle walls. They're really unprepared for an insurgence of this size, whoever is. And Replica also sneaks in, because she's a shape changer. She turns into a little bug of some kind. And then she frees the captured Guardians, and they encounter and face off with Rancor. In the third part, issue 11 of the World of Mutants arc, Gerard becomes the Phoenix and merged with the Volcano Force, just like Jean was back in the day.
This was a little bit of a twist for me because, I don't know if you noticed, but these mutants did have a redheaded telepath in their midst that they could have easily dropped into the volcano. It would have made more sense, I think.
Did they know that the Phoenix Force was ready to be received? Did they? Who knows?
I don't think they even knew it was there. They're not paying attention, Steve. Dictators got to pay attention.
Marvel's publishing history isn't that long after the whole bringing Jean back and saying that the Phoenix Force was something that hosted her and all that business, too. The mutants are teleporting to escape, but it's not without casualties. There were nine at first, Jerry. Now there's only five.
Oof,
and Starhawk flies around and touches everybody's little star really fast at the speed of light and forces the team to teleport back to the ship against their will, and then uses the Phoenix to power the teleporters on their ship and teleport the entire population off of Haven to mainframes, the Vision's deserted world, before Rancor pushes the button to blow the whole planet up.
That's Starhawk. Always thinking.
Proud of him, though.
She is. She's even crying, Steve.
Aww. In the 12th issue, we have a standalone here where Fire Lord is really getting whooped by this new leveled up overkill.
Yeah.
He sends a distress call to the Guardians, and they're answering it. En route, they discover a stowaway, that little shape-changing replica girl. Nikki does not like her.
Uh-oh. No, there's something about this kid she does not like. What could it be?
The Guardians arrive on scene and engage Overkill, and Starhawk replenishes Fire Lord by just grabbing him and flying him into the heart of a sun. I guess there wasn't a volcano around. That seems to be his move, his signature move.
Yeah, it's not enough to just know things. You got to start throwing people into really hot places.
And Nikki is like, "What did you do to
my stud
there?
Muffin?"
And Overkill gets teleported away, even though he was standing his ground against the team. But the Stark have, while this distraction was happening, they've planted a bomb on the Guardians of the Galaxy's ship.
Just somewhere. It's in there somewhere.
And Replica saw that this happened, though, so she can at least alert the team, but they don't know where it is. At the end of this issue, Fire Lord leaves after acknowledging Nikki's attraction for him, but he is duty-bound as the protector of the universe to an ego eon-like being that does seem a little bit like someone we know. He's even got good hair for an ego planet.
He does. Very neat little part down the side.
The 13 issue is the beginning of a two-parter. It's issues 13 and 14 that we get to see who the Spirit of Vengeance is. So this is the 90s, folks. Ghost Rider is the hottest property, so we're going to get a version of Ghost Rider.
Awesome.
The issue opens, issue 13 does, with a team searching for that bomb. It's in the gym. So is Vance and Alita.
No.
Boom.
Uh-oh.
There's also a problem where Starhawk is becoming less tangible the longer he is separated from Alita. It's like a Banner Hulk thing.
Yeah, there's even a little note from the editor. Haven't you noticed him getting dimmer? And of course, looking at it now, I do.
Here we get a couple of interludes again. We get something going on the planet Sarka. A guy named Autolycus, or Autoculus? He
yes.
is the last priest of in an outlawed faith, probably because of their naming conventions.
Ha!
You're a good man, Jerry.
Man,
But this guy, he becomes the Spirit of Vengeance. It's all Ghost Rider style on his death cycle and everything.
Wheels on this cycle.
You know, it's the hover cycles we've all were promised after the year 2000.
Only took 1,000 years, Steve.
Another interlude, we have Brawl from Force. He is, like, betraying Force and taking them all out in service of Malevolence.
Yes.
Then we get the Spirit of Vengeance coming towards the Captain America 2, and Starhawk goes out to engage him and gets totally speared by the death cycle.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm never worried about Starhawk, but I guess now I probably should start being worried about Starhawk.
The Hellfire, it affects his mind. He no longer knows. And we get this awesome profile panel that's like such a Ditko face.
Yeah!
Right? With the teeth and the angle and the nose and the eye. I'm assuming it's an homage because it's so obviously a Ditko face. Alita clears up the misunderstanding between the Spirit of Vengeance and the Guardians. They're both on the side of good. The Guardians of the Galaxy are not the Knights of the Universality Church. But, whoops, Replica, actually. She's a believer. So the issue ends with the Ghost Rider rolling up his sleeves and being ready for round two.
And now it's on.
Issue 14 starts with the battle raging. But they're interrupted when they are surrounded by the Holy Fleet. Holy Fleet! The Spirit of Vengeance flees, and the Guardians of the Galaxy are captured, except for Alita, Vance, and Yondu. There's an interlude where we get to understand Malevolence's plan. She wants to rule countless worlds by becoming matriarch to the Universal Church of Truth, the same one from Jim Starlin's Warlock with the multi-armed Inquisitors and everything. Mm-hmm. Well, the Universal Church of Truth has a protege child that they genetically manipulated to be birthed and become the Magus. And Malvolence's only rival to becoming matriarch to the protege and therefore being able to steer him to her sensibilities, she sees Alita as her rival. So Alita must die.
She's gotta die.
The Guardians of the Galaxy escape the church folk with the help of the Spirits of Vengeance, and they head for the church's homeworld. And Alita gives everyone a jaw-dropping ending cliffhanger as she starts spouting one who knows talk.
Freeze frame of everybody in shock.
Like, oh, she's the one who hated it the most. The last two issues give us a climax of all of these plot threads and interludes. And in issue 15, we get Vance proposing to Alita, of all things.
Yes.
What does she say, Jerry?
She says, how romantic. Yes. Oh, Vance, how romantic. That's how I imagined it.
On the church's homeworld, this protege, this young child, this sort of Tutankhamun boy king, if you will, watches these contestants in battle. All these women warriors are battling for the right to be the matriarch. And in the meantime, the protege is copying, learning their powers as they demonstrate them in battle.
She's like an uber taskmaster.
Yeah, and he's kind of androgynous, but it's a he.
It's a he.
And Malvolence is participating in this playoff system. We get the origin of Interface and the origin of, well, somewhat of an origin of how, at least how he met Tachyon from Force.
Mm-hmm.
We see that Starhawk is just completely crippled. He's lost memories. He's discorporeal. He's having a bad day.
Finally, he's getting what he deserves for being so mean to everyone.
You think so?
Well, I don't think anybody deserves what's going on with him.
Force teleports in and attacks. They're on an assassination mission, and the target is Alita.
How do they do, Steve? How do they do?
Well, Yondu faces off against Photon again, and this time gets to hear her story, what her deal is, how she got turned away from their ways. And Replica, she ends up getting revealed, well, old 85 there, revealed to be a Kree. And that puts Replica into a rage, revealing herself to be a...
Skrull?
Dirty little rotten Skrull. Nikki knew it.
She's a stinking reptile.
Well, members of Force and the Guardians of the Galaxy actually start teaming up a little bit, like Charlie and Broadside and Interface and Martin X, but the rest are all still at odds with each other. At the end, Alita escapes to challenge Malvolence for the right to be the matriarch.
Two will enter, one will leave.
In the double-sized finale, issue number 16, we get Yondu deciding he's got to come to odds with Photon here, and it doesn't last long. He immediately is the better of the two and slices Photon's jugular.
It's pretty brutal, but he's shocked. You can see the look on his face as it happens. His knife falls away, and he's shocked that he did it.
Like, I can't believe she would let herself be that vulnerable. She's one of us, you know?
Jump.
Interface is freaking out because Photon's bleeding out, and he blows off Yondu's right hand. He turns it into water vapor.
Yeah, equally brutal.
I bet you'd like to run some tests on that water.
I think it would fail for just about everything.
Everyone else, in light of this violence, finally chills out. And back on the homeworld of the church, we've got Alita versus Malvolence in their final showdown here. And Protégé... he is taking, well, an obvious liking to Alita over Malvolence.
Yeah, he quickly figures out it's a battle of light versus dark.
Back up on the ship, Martinex makes Yondu a weaponized stump. All these different weapons come out of it like a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah, but better, because it has buttons on it.
There's no hand attachment, though, it seems.
You'd think he would have thought of that. At least a fork or something.
At best, it's still a stump.
Yeah. I was expecting a bow to come out.
Oh, that would be cool. A bow, like, unfolds out of it. But yeah. You know what? The right hand is the arrow-holding hand.
Well, you know, he could be one who knows how to shoot with the wrong hand.
A switch hitter.
Yeah, they exist.
Even more of them exist in the future that becomes the genetic...
it's the opposite trait of the mutants. Mutants are fewer, but switch-hittedness is...
Ambidextrousness is on a rise.
Yeah, ambidextrousness. That's the word I was looking for, yes.
Yeah. Were you looking for that word?
Switch-hittedness, man, Mini come on.
Force and the Guardians team up, finally. These guys have been meant to join forces all along, haven't they?
I'm just begging for it. I wish it would happen.
Starhawk, in a surprising moment, absorbs Alita to save himself and then flees like he always does.
Man, this guy, he's hard to like.
Well, with Alita gone, what's left for Protégé?
Malevolence.
Yeah. But Replica stays behind as kind of his playmate and confidant?
Yeah, he's got to have a bestie.
We'll see how that works out, I guess.
Dirty Skrull.
The issue ends with Vance very disappointed, to say the least, that Alita is gone. And he says, set a course for Earth, I'm getting off this ride. I'm going home, I quit.
Yeah, bummer. Why'd we have to stop here, Steve? Why?
Because the next issue boasts an all-new direction.
Okay, this is too much for me then. I need a break.
But we do get a one-page epilogue that star two of my favorite cosmic apparitions. In the Living Tribunal and good old Eternity.
Yeah, these guys are awesome. And by guys, I mean everything.
And that's the first 16 issues, gang. Jerry, thank you very much for coming back and joining me to go through these. And I hope that you'll agree to... I'll put you on the spot to try to agree to come back to do the next chunk.
I'm saying no. I can't do that. Of course I'll do it.
It gets even better.
I don't believe it could get better.
Galactus shows up.
All right.
That's for a teaser.
Well, I know you like Galactus.
But overall, I thought it was a very Marvel-y series. And they went about trying to do some of the traditional Marvel things, like having the credits being, the editor being Complaint Bot Craig or something, you know. And all that stuff, I think, makes for a homey, Marvel-y experience.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. That's what I enjoyed about it the most, too. It seemed like Valentino really figured out what a Marvel comic is supposed to look like and then just executed it perfectly.
It's a shame we never got to really see him come back and do other stuff for Marvel after he didn't really do that much for Image either. Except be the publisher. I mean art-wise,
right.
You know.
Well, he's probably got time on his hands now. You'd think that somebody at Marvel could pick up a phone.
Craig isn't around anymore. He's Marmaduke money.
Marmaduke money. Yeah. That's awesome.
All right. Thanks again, Jerry. Make sure everybody listens to the Great Expectations with a Big X podcast.
That's right. You can find us on the Earth 2 Network.
And also here on the Deliberate Noise Network, as we draw our line in the sand, we've got the Indie Comic Book Noise podcast. And look for episode 331, which is as fresh as today's headlines, where me and Andrew and Kevin and Phil take a break from talking Marvel and talk about indie books.
Oh, can I say hi to those guys right now? I love those guys, especially that rabbit.
Silly rabbit.
Silly rabbit.
All right, and coming up, we also on Marvel Noise are going to have a year-end roundtable review with Tom Morris like we do every year. Tom's read every book and then some. And even a return of the Fantastic Foresights gang.
Thank
it's
you.
It's safe to come back, Jerry.
I am so happy. I'm so happy. I'm happy for the change in the creative team. I'm happy to have you guys back.
It's time.
It's going to be a good year. 2014 is going to be a great year.
You can find me, Steve Raker, and you can find Jerry McDade on Twitter. You can leave us an iTunes review if you care to, and you can join us for more fun and images and etc. on the Marvel Noise episode thread on the 11 o'clock comics forum. You can get there from marvelnoise.com, and there's a little link on the right-hand side to the forum, or you can search 11 o'clock comics, and it's easy that way, too.
Hey.
Thanks again, Jerry.
Thanks, Steve.
Until Mickey's fires are extinguished for good, make mine Marvel. Later.